Welcome to Naked Word Radio and part the eighth of the curious chronicles of the lost heart, in which the intrepid adventurer plays with fire, gives up on algebra, but still makes it to college. Will he get to stay there? And part the eighth is entitled Reap What You Sow, Spring. I suppose I should feel guilty, but I bloody don't. After 4 terms of the misery I suffer from these people, my so-called compatriots at school, I think it's their own fault. Materi quod seminas, reap what you sow. I used to be afraid of what they would do to spoil my day, but now I'm just resigned to my cupboard being emptied all over the floor because it was untidy. Or perhaps they would take my cap from me before we all have to walk through the town to the cathedral on a Sunday morning, and then punish me for not wearing it. All these things do make me angry, and I save it up for the chance to get my own back. This casual but compulsive cruelty creates a cycle that is hard not to get drawn into. 2 long oak tables, bleached from countless years of scrubbing, stand side by side in the boarding house dining room. Seated around them are 22 boys, one housemaster and one headmaster. Long, heavy curtains keep out the winter night, and industrially bright lamps glare down on the diners below. Conversation is punctuated by barely suppressed chuckles from the boys' bubbling testosterone. It's the last day before the Christmas holidays, and the excitement is palpable. Giles, my arch-companion and co-conspirator, sits opposite me and is holding forth halfway down the second table. As second years, we have risen slightly up the pecking order, and like to pass on the benefits of our vast experience in school. This evening's diatribe concerns end-of-term behaviour. Just how far are we allowed to go as we wreak a trail of havoc in the boarding house? Today's servers clatter the plates down in front of us. It's Friday, and it's macaroni cheese with tomatoes, bread and marge. We are almost the last to be served, and I'm poised with my fork over my plate when a shout is raised. Everyone looks up in surprise. I mean, no one shouts at mealtimes, especially with the head present. But the shout is persistent. It's Matron, and we can see her in the hall at the bottom of the stairs. She's waving her arms and pointing over her head, and suddenly we can see and smell smoke. Fear grips us all as we are marched out of the dining room, through the sitting room, along the corridor and into the classroom, where I spent a large part of my first year. We sit in silence at the ancient name-carved desks, reading whatever books were on the shelves. I exchange a furtive glance with Giles and feel an extra twinge of fear. I can see it in his eyes as well. We have both just pulled off the greatest coup in our bad boy school career, as it somehow slipped out of control. It's the week before term ends. It's customary to play all kinds of tricks on your fellow boarders. Apple-pie beds were the most popular, and more rarely, ragging. This involved ripping blankets and sheets off beds, overturning chairs, and generally making a mess of a room. Every dorm has 5 beds, but the head and second boarder have a room halfway up the stairs. Compact and more comfortable, this room is always a target. And this year, Giles and I had taken advantage of their absence directly before dinner to rag their room, throwing blankets around and tipping books on the floor, emptying drawers and cupboards. We then ran on up the stairs, through the housemaster's room and down through yet more stairs to the dining room. We were just in time for grace. Fire engines arrive, and soon after, the head comes into the classroom to talk to us. The fire in the head boarder's room is out. There was a lot of smoke from a blanket thrown over the heater. It would appear that someone has ragged this room. As you are all aware, we take such misdemeanors very seriously, and those responsible will be dealt with severely. To no one's surprise, there is silence in the room. On our return to school, the smell of freshly applied institutional grey paint barely covers the sooty stink clinging to bedclothes and curtains. There is little talk of who the perpetrators were, but the lower 3 dorms are confined to the school grounds for the first 2 weeks of term. This is a general warning rather than a determined headhunt, and no real deterrent to the truly disobedient. The headmaster interviews each boarder at the beginning of a term. Usually it's about domestic, school and social matters. Of course. He asked me if I was responsible for the fire in the seniors' dormitory, and, of course, I lie, explaining my late arrival for dinner by being in the music room, practicing for my grade 6 piano exam. I could sense his scepticism, see the disbelief in his eyes, and my fate hung in the balance for a few short moments. We both knew that I was a suspect, but he could not prove otherwise, and my belief that dishonesty allows us to avoid responsibility for our actions is reaffirmed. My intuition's need to encourage me to feel remorse over my actions is drowned out by the pleasure of having got away with the crime. Looking back at those days, I can see that this was another small but significant step on the path to losing my connection with my heart. Every time I lied so that I could win, I'd made myself deaf to the gentle inner voice reminding me of the importance of truth. And the admiration from others at my success was more rewarding than the quiet joy of being honest. It's later in the term, and we junior boarders are doing our homework in a classroom under the supervision of a senior boarder. Spring is well on the way, and the early evening light streams through the windows. These are set high in the walls so that we cannot stare out at the school grounds, and I'm struggling with algebra, a language that promises to unravel the secrets of the universe. As far as I care, they can remain in a tangle. I'm not going to miss them. I'm concerned with more mundane and mortal matters, simple survival on a daily basis. Schoolwork is secondary when faced with competitive predators on all sides. From prefects and upwards through the system, corporal punishment is available as correction or torture, depending on the mindset of the perpetrator. And if that's not enough, casual but hurtful violence is used to establish the pecking order. We all contribute to a vast web of deception. Lies are told, excuses invented, because successfully evading responsibility for wrongdoing is rated more highly than taking the rap. Being cunning achieves better results than being honest. I'm learning that it's all about winning, regardless of cost to mind, body, or spirit. Sitting two rows away from me is a boy who has been spending time courting my attention. I have no real idea why and feel no particular draw towards him. He's a third year, so our only contact is out of school hours. He catches my eye and nods. I look away, but the boy in the desk next to me passes me a crumpled ball of paper. With some discretion, I unroll it and read the message. The older boy is requesting a meeting in the corridor by the biology lab. The heavy, numbing stink of formaldehyde that emanates from this room requires it to be off the beaten track, so I know that this is not a public get-together. I also know that he's a smoker, but we all do that around the back of the bike shed, so neither is that the reason. It suddenly dawns on me that this older boy wants sex, and I almost burst out laughing. I know that some of the boys enjoy each other's company, and it's strongly rumoured that the housemaster is fond of boys. He certainly likes caning their bare bottoms, mine included. But boys do nothing for me, and in neat handwriting on the crumpled paper, I firmly turn him down. I pass the ball of paper back, but its passage is spotted by the senior boarder. The note is confiscated and read many times. I can guess exactly where this note will end up. After dinner, I am summoned to the housemaster's room. I know this room well, every wall lined with books, some crowding up to the windows as if they could see outside, and some lying untidily asleep in the dusty corners. A blur of pipe tobacco and aftershave hangs in the air, collecting under the ceiling. He turns on the light and draws the curtains, sits behind his desk, and I stand uncomfortably in front of him. I suddenly wonder who is the most nervous. He taps his pipe out, and while thumbing new tobacco into the bowl, he asks, "Did you mean what you wrote on the note?" I stare at him blankly for a moment, instinctively trying to work out the real meaning of this question before answering. "Of course, sir." He's wondering if I'm worried that I will be found out, that secretly there already was an arrangement between the boy and I. I'm suddenly learning very fast that sex, recently a subject only vaguely in my awareness, is rapidly showing itself to be yet another kind of game. "So you never met him in this way before?" My senses are on high alert now, and even though I have nothing to feel guilty about, For once, I can be honest and don't have to double think or spin a web of alternative truth. No, sir. What about with other boys? No, sir. He strikes a match and breathes the bowl of his pipe into glowing life. Been smoking? Ah, a lie required. Every week I get caned for smoking, despite never having been caught cigarette in hand. Usually another smoker who has been caught informs on me in the belief that they will get a lesser punishment themselves. I know, though, that I receive the same number of strokes that they do. Well, with regards to the note, under no circumstances do we tolerate such behaviour. The boy will be expelled, and you will not talk to anyone about this matter. Understand? Yes, sir. However, you know that communication between boys during homework is forbidden. Yes, sir. And were you focusing on your homework? There is no other answer. No, sir. Drop your trousers, bend down, four strokes. At the time, my response to this event was numbed by the suddenness of it all, from crumpled notes to the boy's expulsion in a matter of days. I did feel guilt at his departure, but I didn't know why. I hadn't done anything, yet felt like I must have, and I was rather startled by the severity of the school's response. Sex was something never referred to by the teachers, and we boys only ever traded casual and poorly informed conversations about it. In my world, sex had been as interesting as a planet alone on the edge of the universe. Suddenly, I had lost my easy innocence. Several years and several jobs have passed by, and once again I find myself in education. I'm attending a teacher training college in Yorkshire and enjoying the companionship of the students, but struggling with the authorities. I spend long hours at the piano, occasionally attending lessons, but mostly improvising on all kinds of themes, especially with one particular pianist. There are two uprights in one room on opposite walls, so we sit back to back. Our focus is our ears, listening for or creating key changes, climbing through moods and diving deep into our imaginations. This college specializes in the arts, so I spend time with actors, artists, and writers. Yes, we're all there to learn to teach, but we can also explore our favored media. There's a body of strong student opinion, and I find myself drawn towards union politics. I get myself elected as the first-year representative and have a seat on a variety of college committees. We don't consider or discuss anything of great importance, but there is a small caucus of tutors led by the principal who disapprove of this arrangement. This is the beginning of the downhill relationship between the principal and me. I attend a village school for my teaching practice, and although I've struggled with some aspects, getting up early and paperwork just two examples, I am passed by my tutor, the classroom teacher, and the headmaster. The principal has other ideas and vetoes their decision. The music department and I have our differences as well, because I rarely go to instrument lessons, and they begin to warn me that I could fail the course. Despite these difficulties, my heart is actually happily involved in the whole process of student life. I can feel a connection with teaching and the school children. All this fighting with the college is, at its heart, just a difference of opinion between the system and me, and I'm sure that there is a constructive path to be found through it all. Fellow students and tutors all hold their own opinions within the education structure and happily survive. I confidently set out to work hard, make amends, catch up on my studies, and give my tutors reason to be proud. My second teaching practice is in an even tinier school than the first, perched on a hill beside two terraces of red brick houses deep in mining country. My second teaching practice is in an even tinier school than the first, perched on a hill beside two terraces of red brick houses deep in mining country. Slag heaps like giant molehills litter the landscape, slate-grey scars spoiling the verdant green mystery of the rolling hills. The local mine is closed, so now there are only 18 children, divided into three classes. I love it here, and do much better than the first time, passing with flying colours. My celebrations are short-lived, though. I receive a summons to see the principal, who has never felt that I am really teaching material, and I suspect He hasn't changed his mind. His office has a wide bay of Georgian sash windows looking out over the college grounds. Capability Brown, an 18th century landscape designer, was given a sweeping hand here. Brush strokes of trees border an islanded lake, and broad swathes of meadow unroll to the skyline, a distant edge circling around to enclose the whole. Directly outside his office, the ground slopes gently away, ambling down to the boathouse beside the lake. The grass is trimmed to perfection, looking brushed and combed. I sit down opposite the principal, his silhouette dark against the sunny day. I have a sense of deja vu, feeling as though I've already heard the conversation that is about to unfold. I suspect that he wants me to leave college, but I'm in a dream and struggling to focus on the present. His voice meanders in and out of my thoughts, and I'm dimly aware of refusing to resign. He informs me that the college reputation will suffer if I have to be expelled, and I am startled back into the present. I look at him and realize he is not concerned with me at all, and hear his next sentence with crystal clarity. "And you are starting a family. It would be very difficult to continue your studies." "But not impossible," I reply. A long and considered silence follows, and I see him carefully putting anger aside. Quietly and deliberately, he says, "Well, I have no choice then but to expel you." There is nothing for me to say as I get up out of my chair and walk round his desk to the window. I look out at a spot 5 or 6 yards from where I stand. It was here on a quiet Sunday that I lay with Bean, my wife-to-be, in the cold spring sun, in a madness of joy and carelessness. I know now that my career as a teacher is finished. I'm not surprised, and to my amazement, I'm not at all saddened. Feeling the principal's impatience bristling up my spine, I turn to face him, smiling. "Sic fiat, so be it," I say. I suppose I should feel guilty, but I bloody don't.